Hi everyone, my name is Patrick Akil, and if you're interested in generative AI, large language models, and some interesting challenges and applications we've seen so far, this episode is for you. Joining me today is Rens Dimadaal. He's principal data scientist over here at Xebia and trailblazing with the technologies as we speak. I'll put all his socials in the description below. Check him out. And with that being said, enjoy the episode. Have you done any like webinar stuff or something like that?
Yeah, I've been here. Like I sat there at the top of the table and then I had like a customer and somebody from my team. And I had to like make sure that was a nice flow of the conversation going on there. It was fun.
How was it? Was it good?
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah, I really like speaking. I really like, but also I also really like being the host there.
Yeah.
To take that type of role to make sure that the flow is right.
It's, yeah, it's I agree.
Really fun it's, to do sometimes.
The first time I went on a podcast as a guest was a bit weird because I was like, okay, I'm just going to go in blank and they're going to ask questions. And then it was a good flow of dialogue. But then I do realize how hard it sometimes is when you're speaking and you're still trying to figure out what you exactly want to say and you don't want to come across as rambling. It's quite hard.
Was that before or after you started hosting your own
podcast? It was after.
Okay, yeah. So you really know what's like on the other side of the table. Yeah.
Also. And I did an intro call. So like I do always intro calls like I did with you for potential guests. Mm-hmm. And other people also do that with me. And in there, the person was like, okay, what do you want to talk about? And I was like, this is your show. What do you want to talk about? So yeah, I had to be like, no, you direct this. I'll be here for
the
ride.
I'm here to lean back.
Exactly. I'll be here for the ride, mostly.
Ah, nice.
Yeah. But what do you do more on a day-to-day nowadays?
So day-to-day, because I was hired here as a consultant, and so I was mostly at the clients, and then I became also more a lead, a principal data scientist over here, so also taking on some management responsibilities.
Yeah.
It was still like 10-15% of my time. But now since March, April, don't really remember exactly anymore, I'm now not full-time in the client anymore. I'm like full-time helping Xebia figure out what are we going to do with Gen AI.
Yeah.
So how is that going to turn into a proposition for us? Well, how does that change the work that we do as tech consultants ourselves? Those type of things. And that means for me, figure out sales propositions.
Yeah.
Giving talks at conferences. Also, part of this also maybe, like to,
good fun.
To spread the word. And making marketing materials, those type of things. Kicking off new developments. Like we have lots of consultants who would like to work with Gen AI.
Yeah.
And when they make something, to inspire them maybe some ideas, but that they don't need that much. But what is really helpful is like when somebody makes something great, to make sure that it actually gets seen and that it gets follow-up.
Yeah.
And that's I think that's a lot of fun to do.
How'd you get into that position? Like, was it an open thing and you applied, or did you really push for it and kind of create it yourself?
The generative AI part, you mean? No, that was, I was asked.
Yeah.
So Stein, my manager, he said like, Rens, I want you to... I think this is going to change the world.
Yeah.
I want you to focus on this.
Pull this.
Yeah. And I in advance wouldn't have thought that would be a possibility.
Yeah.
And then I thought, okay, well I'm going to do it. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
And what is kind of your opinion on kind of Gen AI, where it stands and where it's going in that way?
That's a big one to unpack. Yeah. So where Gen AI stands today and what my opinion of that is. Like, that's the question, right? Like, yeah. So I think right now is a really interesting time.
Mm.
And that's because the capabilities of what is possible has really increased, let's say, in the last 12 months.
Yeah.
But the expectations have also really increased.
Oh, yeah.
And those two uncertainties of like what is actually possible plus what people are expecting of it, multiply just creates a whole lot of uncertainty, I think, in what people think is possible and what's not possible. And my opinion of that is that I think that it's time to, I'm looking forward to it when the dust settles a little bit and we can actually start to build stuff with people. That's also like the feedback that we get from our customers when we speak to them. Okay, now we kind of get what is the sense and the nonsense, what's possible right today and what maybe will be possible in maybe a year or maybe 10 years. We don't know because the progress is so fast.
Yeah.
And I think that my opinion is that there's too many hot takes today. Maybe my hot take is that there's too many hot takes. People are saying, like, yeah, the world's changed. All these, like, the people, like, the world's totally going to change. These people are coming maybe from the NFTs and whatever. And
everyone's going to be jobless.
Fully hype train.
Yeah.
Then you have to fully, we're getting into the doom scenarios. We need to stop now.
This is the beginning.
I really don't like those types of people. But then there's also the people that say, it's totally useless. It's the same. I read an article yesterday. Colleagues shared it about they made a comparison of large language models with psychics.
Mm.
How they basically delude their audience, but also psychics delude themselves. So the people working with LLMs, they delude themselves that it's more capable than it actually is.
Yeah,
I don't think that's the case either, because I see people using it for useful stuff all the time. There's lots of examples of it being applied quite usefully.
Yeah.
So that's not the case either. No. But then to give the nuanced story of, okay, something new is happening and it's useful in some cases, but you need to find out how, and not useful in other cases, yeah, that's less sexy to sell.
So exactly.
It's a bit harder.
I can imagine. Yeah. I can't imagine when there was a time that this kind of new technology came out and everyone kind of was playing with it or talking about it, or have you tried it and see what pops out and was this amazed by it. I do feel like it opens up a lot of doors, but I haven't seen, maybe it's just me, but I haven't seen anything concrete that has landed within an organization that has adopted it yet. I feel like everyone's still trying to figure that out and trailblazing.
To play with it, yeah. So I think maybe you can compare it like with other early apps that did have like fast, like broad adoption. So maybe like the internet, came out, people started to make personal websites and that type of stuff. But it was even broader than Gen AI because it's quite hard to make applications with it.
Yeah.
But also maybe app development, like that's where lots of people was lots of hype and you could see what's the possibility of it and how it could be applied. But then about places where it's already really being used. Yeah, of course, lots of companies are now making little proof concepts and trials with it because they figure it out. But there's also really, like, I've seen some examples in industry that I thought, like, hey, that's actually pretty cool. And they are running it live. So maybe one example is from, I heard about it in the MLOps community podcast, which is also where I'm organizing the Amsterdam chapter of. So that's how I got I heard about it.
Yeah.
It's a company, Honeycomb, I believe.
Mm.
And they are like observability platform. So yeah, you I can send, like, cool.
Yeah.
Nice. So maybe then you could tell me what do they actually do, because I only heard about it, the Gen AI side of it.
It is an observability platform. I had Jessica Kerr on, and I think either she's DevRel there or one of the principal engineers there, but I don't know anything more than it's an observability platform.
Okay, so then we both know part of the truth, that's okay. But so what their product manager said, so they have on their website a... you get like first step, people have to submit all their data to there. Second step is they need to write queries to get like useful stuff from the data that they've sent there.
Yeah.
And they shared that like their hurdle is one, get their customers to upload their data. And the second hurdle for them is to get their customers to write a good query.
Yeah. Get what they need.
Yeah. And they have, and that's important for them because they have a product strategy. So that means you write, you get people on for free and then you hope that they convert. And they found that people who write complex queries convert more likely to paid users.
Mm.
Writing a complex query is a hurdle. So what they made is just below this normal query editor, they put a query assistant where you could in natural language write what you want. And then in the background, it transforms that into their own query language to get the insight. And what did they find when they put that live? The people who had access to this new tool, they converted, they were much more likely to write these complex queries. And of course, and then you know from previous experiments, like, hey, that will probably spill down into more paid users.
Yeah.
And they're using that right now. And that's, I think, a pretty cool win. And I think that's also a really good example because it shows you're not going to put chat everywhere, basically. Like, that's a lazy approach. They integrated into a product in a place where they knew that it could be high impact. So I think that's pretty cool.
It's super targeted. And I always feel like it's going to go into the realm of assisting users into doing something, right? Making something that is or might be complex, making it easier, right? Having kind of a translation in a language or something like that is where I've seen it most applicable, or just guiding someone through and getting the information they need. But then still, you're talking about kind of a digital assistance type of thing.
Yeah, now there's more use cases for that. I think there's like a three buckets that I sometimes like to split it in as one is basically content generation.
Yeah.
So copywriting or maybe helping you with your emails, something like that.
Is that legal, by the way? Like if it generates something, can that be plagiarism as well?
Yeah, that's okay. So let's say you use such a model to, for example, write a blog post. Mm-hmm. Well, then these large language models, they generate text.
Yeah.
Some of the text might indeed contain an idea that was originally thought by somebody else. So if you then start to say, hey, that's my own idea.
That's a problem.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you probably want to look things up in that way. So you don't want to take new ideas from there to do that. But honestly, not most people use these models for that. Usually, what I see mostly is that people have good ideas themselves. They have good source material themselves. And they need, for example, help with writing the text in the desired tone of voice.
Yeah.
Or those type of things.
Yeah.
So that's one side. So content generation is one side maybe. The other one is more search related. So that's also like basically the query example from before. It's becoming easier to maybe write your queries in natural language or to find data from your sources in a less strict way that you have to really have exactly the right keywords to, for example, get your search results.
Yeah.
And then the third way is, that's now with these large language models, it's becoming easier to have maybe we're starting to get a glimpse of being able to get finally maybe chatbots that actually work.
Mm.
Like I've never had a good chatbot experience.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially not if it's like for a company. Like, and ChatGPT is fun to play with, but it's not really a service chatbot for a company or something.
No.
But it does make me optimistic that maybe we'll get there one time.
Yeah.
But then I immediately want to say that actually I think as for companies, I would really advise them not to immediately go into the chatbot route, because I think that chatbots by themselves are kind of like a UI failure.
Mm.
So if you...
If you need assistance, then something went wrong.
Yeah, and that way, this is also like something that I saw in a different talk from the MLOps community. Linus Lee was this. He works at Notion, the Note app. And he said basically, good UI is obvious. Like it doesn't make you think.
Yeah, it's intuitive.
And when you're working with a chat like ChatGPT, you're basically working with an empty slate.
Yeah.
You have to think what has to be done, you have to describe how it's going to be done, and then maybe that model will give you something useful back. But just like maybe to give a slightly different example, lots of people are now putting code into ChatGPT to ask for help.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to take your code, copy paste it into some other tool, and then hopefully get something back and you put it back in. That's not really a nice flow. Like, no. I mean, okay, I don't have to go to Stack Overflow anymore and search through 5 results, maybe ChatGPT, because sometimes it's more helpful for me, but I still have to switch tools all the time.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be great if in my IDE, where you can see everything about the context of what I'm already doing, that is automatically loaded in so that's taken into account when a suggestion is created. Mm-hmm. Where's my cursor? Which other tabs do I have open? What was the last test that I ran that failed?
Yeah, context.
And let's imagine that was automatically already pasted in the LLM before the suggestion is created, so your flow doesn't get broken. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean with that chat is kind of like that UI failure, because if you have to do all these things manually to put them in there, then you weren't able to capture all these other important signals as part of the product that you're making.
Yeah, exactly. It's like having two products next to each other and you have to fill in information from the one product to the other one and then get the output and do something in the first product again. Well, if it's integrated, then it has all the context of where you are currently and it can use that in any suggestion that it needs to.
Yeah. Yeah. And also going back to the Honeycomb example, they could have made a chatbot like chat with your data.
Yeah. Ask for queries.
But they already know that people have a query. They want to search for a query and they want that result to be shown then somewhere so they can add it to the dashboard. You don't make a whole chatbot and everything. No, you integrate it, constrained into the place where you want it. And that's not just useful because it's for the user, it's nicer to use. You can make an optimized user UI, basically. But it's also easier to test if it's doing what it's supposed to, because you give a free-range chat general assistant that can do anything. Good luck testing if it's doing what it's supposed to do. Yeah. But if you say, hey, we have this query tool that's supposed to make it easier, well, then we can see, are people using it more than the old one? Are the queries that are being generated, like as a baseline, are they actually, is the model returning valid query language? Like, would it actually provide a result?
Yeah.
And maybe do people give a thumbs up afterwards if it's okay or not? Well, those are really useful metrics. Absolutely. I can think of those for a query assistant. I cannot think of that for a generic assistant. Yeah, okay, maybe do people get using it and thumbs up, but not the more lower level stuff that gives you a faster feedback loop.
Yeah.
And that's really important if you want to grow faster.
I hadn't thought about it like that before, but it's a problem with any toolbox that you have, right? If it solves every problem, then you're like, okay, when do I use this, right? Do I use it for every problem? No, because it doesn't really solve every problem. It solves a lot. But for tools that are very specific, you're like, okay, when I have this issue, I know exactly that this is the problem and this tool solves this problem.
Yeah.
So then it's hyper-specific.
Yeah, and that's easier to show the value.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, also when you go back to all these companies trying to now adopt this technology, that it's... yeah, it's better to start with a use case maybe where you know, okay, this is specifically, this is the flow, this is how things are now going. Yep. Here we see an opportunity to make things easier, things cheaper, things faster, things better for the user. And then let's see if we can make that work and let's see if we can make that feedback loop running. And that's also what I see mostly happening around me right now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the way I started using ChatGPT was just when it came out, I made an account immediately. Whenever I had a question or I wanted to just play around and see what this tool did, I would log into their thing, fill in my information. Usually I would have to re-log in actually. And then with Inxibia, I don't know if you were involved, but we now have this Slack GPT plugin and I love it. It's basically, it's a Slack plugin and it does the exact same thing, except when I see some stuff on Slack, I'm like, oh, let me double check that if that's correct or if this is how you would do that. I go to Slack, right? I open up my messages with Slack GPT and I ask my questions and it pops up. I like that. Plus all my information is more so prioritized, which makes a lot of sense in that way.
Yeah. Thanks for saying that. So it was originally my idea.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Yeah. And together with colleagues, with Kyle and with Ismail, we made the first version.
Yeah.
And it's getting quite some use.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Is it open source?
We haven't open sourced the repo. Maybe we just should because there's nothing secret in there.
I was going to say, yeah.
We should.
I do think it's a cool initiative. Yeah. And I talk about it to friends and they're like, can I use it? And I'm like, I don't think so. Maybe not yet.
Yeah. Yeah. So if anybody wants it, if one person tells me to open source it, I will.
Put it in the comments. Yeah. It's some good stuff.
Yeah. I think that's also really, but it was also important for us to make that because I think I see all one, because it's really cool to see that all our colleagues are using it. The positive feedback is really nice.
Yeah.
Also because people who go to chat.openai.com, like, their data is being used to train new models.
Spill your secrets.
Yeah, and that's really not okay. Like, that was a Samsung. Famously, they put some sensitive data in there.
Mm.
And that's really harmful because also then, I believe it was in the same news article that then the company said, okay, we're shutting down everything. No more generative AI for anybody. And that's maybe also not the solution. So I think being able to have tools that you can use responsibly, that you are safe, feel comfortable with using, but also managing the user's expectations with it well is also really important. I'm curious what you think about that. So you say that you use it.
Mm.
What do you think of the message that we send you every day with, like, this is what's happening with your data?
I ignore it.
But do you know what it says?
I read it once, probably at the very beginning. Yeah. I was like, okay, yeah, don't fill in any private information, anything that I wouldn't like fill in Google or anything that would be kind of, I'm also on a project where there's a non-disclosure agreement. Yeah. So anything information with regards to what we're doing and the way we're solving it, don't put it in there. And I was like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. But usually when I'm like, okay, I program in Go, I'm like, and I have to do stuff with bytes. I'm like, okay, how do I byte shift this? Or how, if this is my input and this is my output, how do I get this? And it creates a function. And sometimes even to my frustration, it's wrong like over and over and over again. And then I'm like, we're not there yet. I'll just write this myself. Yeah, but most of the time, it really helps me speed up. Like, I had this huge like switch statement, for example, because we have quite a complex data model, and it was from proto generation. We had an enum, and let's say the enum had like 30 fields, and I had to make both mappings, so from a specific switch statement to one, and then the reverse. And I'm quite handy with my IDE; like, I can duplicate my cursor, and I could do it. But then I was just like, okay, let me try this, right? Just with a dummy example. Okay, would it do that? And it did do that. And then I was like, okay, if this is my spec, can you increment all these things and I don't have to do it manually? And it did everything. And then I was like, okay, this is quite nice. It saved me a bunch of time.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Do you use Copilot, stuff like that?
I haven't dabbled with Copilot yet because I don't know. I haven't tried it. I feel like I'm still super effective. So then I was like, okay, would it make me even more effective or is it going to be distracting, like generating or suggesting stuff that I know I don't want to use?
Yeah.
So I very consciously step out of something and very specifically ask for certain questions and then integrate back and get back to it.
Nice.
What about you?
Yeah, so I use Copilot just in my IDE.
Yeah.
I like it for the autocomplete, basically.
Yeah.
I would really like it if I could also chat with my data, like what I said before, like if I have a chat window that already knows the context, that's what I think I would really like.
Yeah.
So I could stay in the flow more. And what I'm came across and what I'm actually curious about is how this is going to unlock like new ways of coding, basically. Mm. So there's this product I came across. It's, I think, sweep.ai or something like that. And basically what they say is you write an issue in the background.
Yeah.
And basically an LLM makes a pull request.
Yeah, I've heard that.
So if you just write like, hey, I need to fix this function or write the reverse, whatever, like you said, like a simple task, maybe it will be possible. And I think that, why I think that's interesting is because it shows how the workflow is going to change, can change. And I'm not saying it's good enough today, but like you see what the progress that's being made. And I think that we are going to get there.
Yeah.
And I'm really curious about like how the way of working is going to change because of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I talked to a guy that he's a YouTuber, he's Forrest Knight, and he loves to do research. So also when ChatGPT came out, he was skeptical and then he did a lot of research and then he was like, okay, this can change in exactly the way that you say it, in that you have kind of this AI team member that can pick up something that maybe a junior team member would do as well. And still you can review it and be like, okay, no, this is not really upholding our conventions in this case, or this is actually wrong. And then it can still do that and their output is like tremendously faster. What I think is interesting is, let's say it goes that way, for you to be able to review whatever this AI thing is going to create, you have to have the knowledge. So then are you going to hire more junior people and educate them to get to that level? Or are you going to solve like the easier stuff with AI? And then it becomes a bigger hurdle for people to kind of get into this field where they have, let's say, more senior related knowledge. That scares me because that means that the information is going to be a bit finite, I feel like. Unless people use then AI as well to educate themselves faster, but that's a hard thing. You need more hands-on experience, I feel like.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's interesting. I'm not scared about that, I think. And because the dynamics are, okay, so let me put it this way. Were you scared when auto-formatters came?
No.
And pre-commit?
No.
Those type of things. I think this is kind of like the same thing, but maybe a little bit further, right?
Could be.
And even junior developers, you could still get them. Maybe you get a meta thing where you have, let's say, sweep delay or whatever, like some tool that makes automatic pull requests on issues if they're small enough, basically. Yeah. And then you say, like, the challenge is, okay, I have senior team members and they could totally review that code and then go ahead. And if junior team members who maybe would have written the pull request and now they don't have anything to do, so then why would I hire them? And that's why I get into the squeeze of only having senior people, but then I get no new senior people because the juniors don't get grown up. I think in the practice, at least if that would happen in my team, I would tell the juniors, okay, you take a first pass of reviewing that code.
Yeah.
So and then their role would change. I'll take a second pass. And for example, like that, stuff like that, I think would happen.
Yeah.
Or they, I think it will always, people always adapt their way of working and everything. I mean, in car manufacturing plants or whatever, people did stuff manually, then they automated stuff and people moved more into quality control.
Yeah.
Those people also still had to be trained and everything. So I think it will change also how people will get trained and everything. Like I never learned how to do, I did learn how to invert matrices by hand, but never really did it because it's really painful.
Yeah. So never needed it.
But still, I learned matrix algebra. And because I didn't have to learn how to do the matrix inversion by hand, I could go way further into all these things. And I think that will happen as well. So junior developers who have access to all these toolings,
yeah,
they can maybe learn how to do software engineering, systems design. They can maybe faster go to higher level concepts of how to make things work together in the big picture, because they don't have to worry so much about the relatively low level stuff.
Yeah.
So we,
I like that. Yeah. So their role would change, and probably the way they would learn would also change, because maybe less hands-on and more so a quality control. I think that's a good example of it, doing less manual work and more so quality control. But then still, I feel like because the field is quite broad and there's a lot of knowledge aspects, right? You can go deep in a lot of aspects. I do think it's going to be a bit more hurdle kind of getting into the field. Already now, I mean, I'm on subreddits a lot, and people also reach out to me. They're like, okay, how much projects does my portfolio need? And I have a real hard time answering that because I don't have a portfolio.
Seven.
Like, yeah, I can say that, but then someone's going to really like, and be like, no, seven didn't do the trick, and then I'm going to feel bad. Yeah, like there's no cookie cutter mold, yet people do struggle to kind of land their first job, for example, especially if they don't have the educational background, if they've done something else. And I feel like if an AI tool then already solves kind of easier problems, then it might be a bigger hurdle for them to get into the field as well.
Yeah, because also the skills that were maybe distinguishing them before are not going to distinguish them today anymore. But that happens all the time, right?
Fair enough. Yeah.
So, but then the creative question is, how do you now how do you then distinguish yourself in that new in a world where maybe the basics are not special anymore?
Yeah, I think that's the right question.
I mean, like 5 years ago, 7 years ago, it was really special if you could train a machine learning model. That's not special anymore. So you had to distinguish. You have to distinguish yourself in different ways.
Yeah.
And the way I think about it, maybe in the big picture, if I can get a little bit hand wavy, is that what I see is that if you say let's say there's three types of knowledge, like factual knowledge, knowing how to bit shift or whatever you were talking about before,
sure,
and how to apply things, how to just write code that works. And the wisdom, like knowing why something is a good idea or if something is not.
Yeah.
Maybe a more simpler example that I've given to other people is like factual knowledge, knowing that tomato is a fruit, application, knowing how to make a salad, wisdom, not putting fruit in the tomato in a fruit salad.
Mm.
So what I think is that with AI, like a generative AI specifically, we are getting to a case where, so with the internet, factual knowledge became less distinguishable. Knowing all the capitals of the world,
yeah,
not so special anymore. Knowing the whole
fingertips,
knowing the whole New York map, okay, as a taxi driver, less important because you just have Google Maps. Like stuff is changing.
Yeah,
knowing how to apply things became more important. Driving around well, all the things also good became more relatively more important than knowing all the streets.
Yeah,
now we get to that Gen AI can maybe write more code, do more things for you, automatic driving as well.
Mm-hmm.
What becomes relatively more important for people to do? The wisdom, like knowing whether something should be done in the first place or if it's a good idea, if it's the thing is well done or not. Quality control, curation, evaluation, all these different words for that type of thing. So if I'm going back to your question about you're a new developer and you want to make a portfolio, maybe now like what we'll see as a trend is that it will become more important for you to show that you have high quality judgment.
Yeah.
Of what is good, is what bad, what should be, how it should be made, blah de da, rather than showing that you can provide beautifully formatted code. And I think that's actually pretty optimistic. That's quite interesting because that means that we need to have people with, good quality judgment.
Yeah,
I like to see that more in the world. So.
I agree. I agree with what you say. But judgment for me, maybe this is just how I learn. Right? Yeah. Judgment was really when I got hands-on experience, when I saw that, okay, this thing that we did was not as effective as the next thing, or when I moved from project to project and I was like, okay, we actually have less processes and we're going faster. So processes are not always a good, like those things you learn from actually experiencing.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's hard if the application or an AI solution kind of knows that and knows best practices and really good fundamental knowledge, basic stuff. And then you come into that and you're more supposed to be like, quality control, then you're gonna go off of hearsay or you're gonna experience in a different way. And maybe it's because I don't really have or foresee how that would go rather. And I only have my own experience.
Yeah. Okay, maybe I think there's two sides to that. So one is about how to learn things, right? So there we also, I don't know, did you have like graphical calculators in high school?
Yeah.
Like you were not allowed to use those until a certain point.
Yeah.
Because you had to learn the foundations first.
Yeah.
I think we're going to get the same here.
Mm.
Second is that because we had those, you could go faster, go further in high school already than people did before. So I think that's still the topic about learning. I think that will be there. The other part is about when you say like evaluation. When I say that wisdom axis about what we have to do, it's not just about quality control. It's also deciding what should be.
Exactly. The why.
The why. Like, yeah. And for example, designing figuring out if something is a cool, good use case, something worth building.
Yeah.
I think that's, and then if you talk, we'll go back to the use cases. I think that today it's easier than before as a single person maybe to make a web product that does something really neat.
Yeah.
For example, auto transcribing YouTube talks, like go from a YouTube video and automatically take like from the video all those frames that are actually different slides from a conference talk, use Whisper or something to get the transcript out and to automatically go from YouTube to blog post, interspersing the slides plus the transcription of what the speaker says into something.
Yeah.
Like 7 years, 5 years ago, 2 years, 3 years ago, that's pretty hard to make. Nowadays, with Whisper plus this type of large language models to maybe format it a little bit. Simon Willisson wrote a cool blog post about this.
Yeah.
This is pretty makeable.
I did it myself, actually.
Yeah. But if you're talking about portfolio stuff, like this stuff is like, it's all possible right now. So I think actually it's really, really, this is a good time to make a cool portfolio showing that you're creative with how to use these tools.
Yeah. It's like we have a lot of building blocks. And rather than figuring out how to create this building block that does this thing, you can use them and hook them together and create something that solves a problem or just shows something cool.
Yeah.
And that is easier than I think it's ever been.
Yeah. What did you make?
I suck at writing summaries for my podcast.
Yeah.
I've stopped doing it. I just do the outline, which is the timestamps and what we talk about. So my idea was on an innovation day, okay, if I have my audio file from the podcast, I want to give that to Whisper and it's going to give me the transcribed version, and then I'm going to feed that into ChatGPT, and I'm going to be like, okay, this is the podcast, this is the context, can you write me a summary?
Mm-hmm.
And it did the thing. It just took a long time. Also, I didn't want to pay, so I had like a limited amount of characters and stuff like that. But this was early on. And a summary came out, and I was like, this is actually fairly doable. Like if you tweak this or if you use this as a base template, you can do a lot of cool stuff with this. And it was my first stab at like playing around with Whisper AI and stuff like that.
Cool.
Yeah.
If you need like access to a bigger model, like 32,000 tokens, it's like 50 pages of text.
Yeah.
We have that.
So okay.
Let me...
I'll let you know.
Yeah, let me know.
I'll do a continuation.
Yeah.
That was some fun
stuff. You can
even
do it in SlackGPT, I think. So.
Yeah. That was before SlackGPT was there. And it wasn't really because I was actually going to use that. It was more like, let's see what is possible.
Yeah.
Like how far is this a thing? It was an idea. Mm. And then actually we did it. And I was like, this is some cool stuff.
Yeah cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
Exactly. When it comes to, I want to jump back into organizations because let's say before SlackGPT or ChatGPT, we had organizations which wanted to make data-driven decisions, right? But before you need to, before you can do data-driven decisions, you have to have data. You have to have collected data and you have to have a story. You have to have a history of a lot of data already. So then when organizations wanted to do that, sometimes they saw that, okay, if we want to do that, we can only do that months down the line because now we're going to start collecting the data that we need to be predictive in that way. Are organizations ready to kind of adopt LLM models, you feel like, or LLMs rather?
Mm.
Or is there still challenges with kind of integrating it into the organization and in a product in that way?
There's definitely challenges.
Are they the same or are they different?
Different.
Yeah.
So some things are the same. You need to have your basics in place to be able to get access to your own data and everything, all those things. But I think it's more interesting to talk about the differences. So one difference is that before, to be able to get to your first model that you could maybe somehow integrate in a product, service, decision-making process that you have, took you quite some effort to get the data, make sense of the data, train the model, host it somewhere as an API, or maybe set up some pipeline as a batch process.
Yeah.
And it all had to be done by a data scientist, somebody who knew how to do those things. now with these large language models, to get to your first thing, I'm not saying that this is how you should do it, mm-hmm. but you can do it this way. You can go to openai.com, to GCP, with your models, use the Palm model, whatever, write a prompt, and you have an endpoint that basically gives you the thing back.
Yeah.
So that quick win of like seeing the first result, that has gone down by a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Now that doesn't work in reality. So that's one difference. But the other difference is that while it's so easy now to make something like a first result,
yeah,
making it actually viable and desirable for the long term, there's some different parts there. For example, costs, like those models, large language models that you can use as an API, are quite expensive.
Okay.
So you have to really think about, okay, does this makes is this really value add for my service? Is it worth the benefit?
Yeah.
Latency. So these models are quite slow to respond. Like, these are huge models. It's really impressive how fast they can return things, but compared to a recommendation model just giving you, okay, these are the five next things you should watch on your favorite streaming website,
yeah,
they're much slower. And maybe you've heard of it, like websites like Booking and Amazon, they do these studies of like, how much does, let's say, 100 milliseconds slower website, what does it mean for our sales and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's insane.
It's insane.
It's insane.
But then if you look at that with the response times of these large language models, then you see like, okay, this is not going to work real time.
No.
So that's already a case also, like, how are we going to solve that? That's different because your own models like usually are way faster. And then there's the thing about how do you actually make sure that one version of your LLM system is better than the other one? Because you have your prompt,
mm-hmm.
you have maybe some other settings that you can also ask an API, like temperature and all these little things that you can tweak to kind of tweak what comes out of your what you get as a response from the model.
Yeah.
But being able to really test, like, is A better than B,
mm-hmm.
is quite tricky. And the reason is that, well, with it's really hard to get good metrics for this.
Okay.
So maybe to go back to like more traditional predictive AI machine learning type of things that we've been doing for a long time, let's say spam classification or whatever. What you usually do is you get lots of examples.
Yeah.
Mails that are spam or not spam, and the labels spam, not spam. And then you can train a model that predicts for a new given text, is this spam or not? Well, then you can see how accurate is that model on a held out data set. Okay, because it's just ones and zeros, you can see accuracy, precision, recall, all this stuff. But yeah, now let's say we're making a tone of voice assistant that can turn any text into the tone of voice for your favorite company.
Yeah.
Okay, we have input text, and now we get output text. And how do we judge that? What metrics do we use for how well it is?
Yeah.
That's quite tricky. And then you go, okay, well, we're gonna have people label this. Okay, sure, you're gonna get people to label the tone of voice of the output text. Great. And now we have a new model. And you're gonna let them also label all that text. And how are you gonna actually totally manage that?
Which one do we actually pick?
And like, do you have a good process for letting people evaluate the tone of voice of your company? Like, that's been training annotators or thinking about stuff like that. That's just a whole lot harder than previous business cases, at least in predictive cases, where you just have labels that are maybe generated naturally, like,
yeah,
people, yeah, spam, not spam, whatever. But this type of stuff is usually a lot harder to evaluate. And I think that's really an open challenge.
Because there was a right and a wrong in most cases, except now it can be more opinion based, right? If it,
yeah,
gives you a tone of voice thing, a lot of marketeers are going to have an opinion. But if both texts are in line with the tone of voice, then both could be correct. So then you have to pick one. Which one is actually better?
Yeah.
I don't know if it actually then matters. If both are good, does it matter? And is there going to be significant difference between which ones?
Mm-hmm.
But I think when we're talking about measuring, it is a hard thing to then measure which one is actually better.
Yeah.
You have to A/B test it, I guess.
Yeah, and that's the challenge. So I like to think like about three types of metrics, and like the success metrics, stuff that you really see once you're in production, like the feedback from the user or whatever, like really the things that you care about. And then you have maybe driver metrics, which is the stuff that you as a development team can see going up or down, but maybe without going live.
Yeah.
And you know that they're kind of related. So for example, if my spam classifier gets more accurate, then probably we'll get more users or people will be happier using my email service. And then you have guardrail metrics. And those are the metrics that you don't necessarily want to go up, but they should just not drop below a certain level.
Yeah.
And I think that with large language models, what I find relatively easy is the success metrics, like stuff in production. Okay, do people like the service? Do I get thumbs up from results? Okay, sure.
Yeah, did it help them?
Guardrail metrics is also kind of okay because you can have, let's say, checks afterwards, like, hey, is this text biased, toxic, whatever. There's some relatively standardized stuff for that. Mm. Or for example, you could, if you say tone of voice, for example, does it have any of these forbidden words? Okay.
Scratch those.
That's okay, but that's a really low bar to pass.
Yeah.
So that's a more guardrail metrics. But that middle part, being able to iterate on your system without going live, I think that's quite hard in cases where indeed, as you say, there's multiple ways to be right. It's ambiguous between people. And that's a bit of an open challenge, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm interested to see where it goes. I mean, when you were laying out kind of the differences in LLMs being really fast to get up and running, right? Because you have something, you can query it and you have a certain output, latency might be longer. You also mentioned that this is probably not the right way to do it. If you would have kind of a clean slate, an open field, how would you implement it then? Would you create something yourself or how would you go about it?
Yeah, also there, it depends on the use case, and a big qualifier is like, what data are you using?
Yeah.
And can you, what agreements do you have with, let's say, a large language model provider on privacy and all of those things?
Mm.
Major cloud providers have stuff like, okay, your data never leaves your cloud perimeter. So as long as you're okay with storing your stuff on our cloud, then you should probably also be okay with putting it in a large language model. Okay, that's nice.
Sounds like a good deal. Yeah.
But some companies have data that they are not comfortable with putting on their cloud service provider, but maybe they still want to use LLMs for that, for example.
Yeah.
Okay, or so that's already like one big qualifier, but maybe we can park that one for now. But I would do, if I could have a clean slate, let's say a project, is I would probably start with an open source, with a provided model from a cloud provider or like from OpenAI, use that as an API just to get it up and running quickly.
Yeah.
And from there, I would become very rigorous about collecting that feedback, finding a way to test without going live again, if I'm making it better or not.
Yeah.
Make sure that I'm really good at actually making sure that it also really translates to things live getting better or not.
Mm-hmm. Not just in a sandbox.
Yeah, not just in a sandbox.
Yeah.
And once I'm capable of being able to just to test those improvements, and then it becomes like looking, where's the bottleneck, right? Like classic product development, basically. And that can be like, hey, it's... maybe it's because it's too slow. Okay, well, then we can try different things. Is it maybe because the quality is not okay? Well, then we're going to try other things.
Yeah.
And I really believe that being able to start quickly, that's the big benefit. Being hard to test and knowing how to iterate on your product like this.
Yeah.
That's the hard part.
Those are open challenges.
Yeah. And what's interesting, let's say for the real machine learning expert colleagues that I have also, is how can you go... For example, what can open source models do to take away some of the hurdles that you have now with just using a model as an API? Mm. Because you can use smaller models. Like once you have gathered your data, then you can use a model that's maybe 10 factors smaller and train it specialized for your task. And that's
going to make it faster, no?
Can make it faster.
Yeah.
And also cheaper because you're not using that super expensive commercial endpoint anymore.
Yeah.
It can also make it easier to deal with your data issues, for example.
Yeah.
So I think that's pretty interesting.
I could imagine. I like the comparison that you made when it comes to kind of standard way of product development, right? Testing and iterating as fast as possible and seeing if it gains adoption, if it has the benefits that you envision,
mm-hmm.
right? If the benefits outweigh the costs in that way as well. And even live, doing the same, right? Iterating over and over and making it better in that way. I like that you put open source in there as well, in that it is an option. Because I was wondering what your take is now that you have these quite substantial large companies that kind of own these large language models and it is not actually open, right?
Hmm.
Is that an issue that you foresee?
Yeah, it's in... Yeah, there's multiple issues there.
Yeah, right.
Right. So one is cost, latency, not transparent how it was created or whatever. So if you are in a situation where you need to be very transparent about how your system works,
yeah,
and one of the components in your system is an entirely black box created by a company that doesn't even say on what data the model was trained.
Yeah.
And good luck, good luck explaining that. So those are definitely issues. Mm. Yeah. And that's just, I think that, yeah, and then also being able to tune it, that's like what I said before. I think that's a big one.
Yeah. A lot of people I talked to, they were more talking about the ethical side of it, right? That if you truly want to have this technology that's going to transform a lot of fields, then the best result would be to have everyone kind of, to use collective intelligence in that way, right? And if there's backing and there's a lot of, how do you say that? There's a lot of capitalism, and it's driven by that sort of mindset, that it might steer into a direction that it would be other than, how do you say that? It would steer into a direction, and that direction would not be the same as if it were open, let's say, for everyone. And I feel like that's a hard one, because we're never going to know kind of this other variant unless some open source variant comes out, which is has the same backing, the same financials, I guess, but it's not driven towards the same financial gain in that way.
Yeah, I'm thinking, I think we see this with more technologies in places, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like phones, you have the closed versions and people making like the fair phones and whatever, which are maybe more hackable and whatever, or...
Yeah. You're dropping slightly off the mic.
Oh, sorry. Thanks.
No worries.
So I think those things are important. I'm less concerned about, let's say, that it's companies making these models and making them available because they have an incentive to make something great, a service some people can use. What I'm more concerned about is, one, if everybody's playing by the same rules.
Mm.
And that means that on the one side, for example, if a big company can scrape the internet, take all this data that nobody really gave them permission to use, and just do it anyway.
Yeah.
And that then afterwards they start lobbying to, for example, stop this exact practice or whatever.
Because they already have it.
They already have it, yeah. Or whatever, making it, or like that I find hard. That it's infeasible for open source collectives to spend millions on training like a gargantuan model.
Yeah.
I'm less concerned about that because I think, well, if it's really that valuable and whatever, then a second competitor will step up and they will try to outcompete the first ones. Like if the rules of the game are fair, then that's okay. But the challenge is, it's not that case.
Yeah.
Like, you know, with OpenAI, they scrape the internet and everything. Copilot has issues with GPL code being in there, and that if it can generate that code, that's not okay. So I think those things I am more concerned about. It's on the ethics side.
But the playing field is unfair.
Yeah, yeah. There's a nice example on the image side of that, where like these huge models like DALL-E and Stable Diffusion and whatever, they are training on lots of images on the internet. And then artists are really upset because these models are really good at copying their style, style that they spent years honing as a craft. And then now with the click of a button, somebody else can just steal it.
Yeah.
I understand that they are upset. And I also really like one example. It was like this image of... look, the point is like they're suing, but it's really hard as a small artist to make a dent.
Make a stand, yeah.
And there was this one initiative, and then people started to make like images with Mickey Mouse, for example, using Stable Diffusion, doing awful things like with a hatchet and blood and everything.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's like Mickey has done it again. And then the idea was, okay, just basically bully or tease Disney into suing these companies that are making those models, because Disney is really good at companies that are infringing on their trademarks, basically.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, I'm really curious how this will play out. For me personally, I think that it's really important to make sure that just your use case doesn't return those results, or to have good monitoring, testing, anything, to use all those things. But also be honest that for me, the temptation to use the technology is too large to say no. That the possibility that some of the code is being generated might include this.
Yeah.
The GPL is going to totally stop me from using it. Although we do have, within Xebia, we have Copilot, and there we do have, for example, the filter on, like, hey, there's like a post-hoc filter. If this looks like code that's actually in known GPL databases, then don't return it, for example.
Ah.
And that's also a way to mitigate it, basically.
Yeah. So, yeah.
It's a gray area for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like maybe it's because like I haven't seen something before, but for me it's never been like this before. I feel like the adoption went really fast also, and it's quite widespread. A lot of people know about it, at least people I talk to. Maybe it's my generation more so. But in any case, I feel like it's also very accessible. You can show it to other people.
Yeah.
Showed it to my parents, showed it to my aunts and stuff. And they were all like, oh, this is interesting. Can you do it in my language? That was that was one I got. Can I do it in Turkish? And I was like, I'm gonna try. And some stuff came out and they were like, nah, I mean, it's not as good as the English version.
Yeah.
Which is fair. But then because it is so widespread, then all of these gray areas all of a sudden simultaneously pop up. Like the artist example, I mean, that's a painful one for the artists, right? And it's that's the consequences. You could see that. But then what can you do about it? I feel like also because the possibilities are so cool, I feel like there are a lot of possibilities that we've never thought of before even, or that we always thought were possible, but now they're more so at the fingertips. That stuff is moving fast. And that because of that, you are going to have a lot of gray areas, but hopefully the end result, the things we're going to build and implement are going to be worth it. That's kind of my hope, I feel like.
Yeah, I think I agree. It's a tool. You need to use it in the right way. I mean, a hammer in the wrong hands is also not a great idea.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Cool, man. This was a lot of fun. How did everything go? What do you think?
That was nice. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on, man. This is a lot of fun. I'm going to round it off here then. Rens Dimadal, I'm going to put all his socials in the description below. Check him out. Let him know you came from our show. And with that being said, thanks for listening. We'll see you in the next one.